So my first question for you, David, is what does Virgin Steel have going on? What are you guys up to? And talk about what's going on currently with the band right now.
Sure, okay. We just did a bunch of gigs over the past several months in Europe, and even we did some stuff in the States. We just did this 70,000 tons of metal thing a few weeks ago, where we sailed out from Miami to the Caymans and back with like 40 other crazy metal pirates, and that was quite nice, quite cool. And we've been quite busy in the studio re-releasing tracks, doing new tracks and whatnot. We just did the Age of Consent reissue with all kinds of new bonus tracks. Novel Savage came out a few months before that with all kinds of bonus tracks. And now we're doing Life Among the Ruins, which will be out, I believe, in June. And that'll have, like I don't know, somewhere between 7 and 11 bonus tracks on that. And at the same time, we're doing what's going to be the new album, which we hope to get out before the year is through. It's probably somewhere between October and December, I think.
Now, you know, talk about the reissues, because I mean, you reissued some of those albums before, and I know, how do they differ from the other reissues that you'd put out, say, like, you know, 10, 12 years ago?
Oh, they got a lot more tracks on them. Every time we get a chance to reissue something, well, it's never just like, okay, just put it out again. It's always like, okay, what can we do? And it's always like additional tracks, like Noble Savage and Age of Consent both have extra CDs. There's 2 CDs each. And also, this time, they're vinyl as well. We've got vinyl going again because SPV, our label that we're on now, is very keen on the vinyl. And it's nice that we were able to do vinyl for the last new album, the Black Light Bacchanalia, and the 2 reissues that we just did. So Life Among the Ruins will also have that vinyl treatment as well. And as I said a moment ago, yeah, there's a lot more bonus tracks than ever before. Some of the albums have not been reissued, but so they're going to be Like Invictus Never Was reissued, or the House of Atreus stuff, or obviously the last 2 albums weren't reissued, and Marriage was reissued once, but they're also going to get, you know, the full treatment with extra tracks as well. So yeah, we're always adding to these things. The reason why we reissue them is because we changed labels, and the older situation, you can't get those versions of the records anymore, so they have to be reissued. Otherwise, you know, new fans who turn on to the band can't get the catalog if it's not out there. So that's why we have to reissue it. So to make it interesting for somebody who may already have the record, there's, like, you know, always like at least 30, 40 or more minutes of new music. Not that anybody who previously bought the record should have to go out and buy the record again. They don't, of course. It's really for the new fans who just get into the band.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I've noticed, and I remember buying the Age of Consent reissue back in 1998, and, you know, there was a lot of liner notes, a lot of cool stuff with that album, and I really, really like that record quite a bit nowadays. And, you know, talk a bit about the making of that record, because in reading the liner notes, it sounds like making that album was quite chaotic, and, you know, give us a little bit of insight of how insane it was to record that album.
Oh, the record was a nightmare to make. We had made Noble Savage prior to that, which was relatively easy to make. We were in and out of the studio in a, you know, matter of weeks. Everything was quite organized, and then we came to do Age of Consent, and it just seemed like we had this engineer who, while he was a very good engineer, was just very, very uptight, and he made me uptight and the guitar player very uptight, so nothing sounded good to us. We were constantly going in and erasing what we had done the day before. We spent like months doing stuff like that. It was just kind of ridiculous. And I was living in the studio for a while, living in the vocal booth. It was a very, very crazy time. I think some of the best moments during the record was when that guy had to take on a break for some reason. I forget what the story was. And we got the engineer back who we did Noble Savage with, and we recorded a lot of stuff very quickly with him and ended up keeping a lot of stuff there. And then, you know, got back to the mixing stage, and all kind of worked out at the end of the day. But I hated the record when we first finished it, because it was just the sequence was wrong. I didn't want that the original order or how it went. And just the tension of doing it all, I just, like, really didn't like the record. But then I grew to appreciate it and like it a whole lot more when we reissued it the first time, because I wrote special new bonus tracks for it and resequenced it, and that made much more sense to me. And now, of course, I love the record, and this version I'm very excited about. All, re-release that came out a few months ago.
Well, I definitely like the reissue because the second disc has a lot of really cool stuff on it, and I thought it was interesting you did a cover of Down by the River.
And oh, yeah, that was, you know, occasionally we'll delve into some strange terrain. That was one of the things that was just a product of my youth. I used to jam with this kid, Dave Ferrara, who was a longtime friend of the band on that one. And one day we were just hanging out, jamming and whatnot, drinking wine, and that one came up, and we decided to do it. And I said, oh, if we're going to do it, then you know, I want to radically transform it into something else. And slowed it way down and did this you know, other treatment of it, which turned out quite well. People seem to really like that one.
Well, you changed the track listing around, too, you know, on the reissue as opposed to when the original album came out. And, you know, I always thought The Burning of Rome was such a great choice for an opening song. And I've opened my show quite a bit with that song, but I think that was a great choice to open up the album.
Yeah, it wasn't in the original 1988-89 version. It was On the Wings of the Night. Yeah, that was really... There was a lot going on at that point in time. We had management then that was trying to push us into, I guess, more of the Motley Crue, Bon Jovi camp, because those bands were very big at the time. And some guys in the band were into going in that direction, and some people like myself and the guitar player were not really into going into that direction. So it was a bit of friction there, and I tried to, you know, appease everyone by writing things that that could maybe go in that direction, but at the same time I was still proud of, and that still fit into what my concept of what the band should be. So I came up with things like On the Wings of the Night, and I wrote the big ballad Cry Forever, and Edward and I wrote Tragedy. So, you know, there's a bit of a, you know, gulf between, no, not a gulf, but there's definitely a bit of a difference between that and like Night and Winter and Burning of Rome, which was really where we wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. But you know, at the time we had to kind of, I had to appease, you know, a lot of different factions and keep the whole thing going. And it, you know, it was what it was, and there it is. And that brought in Stay on Top as a cover. Everyone liked that. That seemed like it was kind of a heavy track, but at the same time it was kind of like quote unquote commercial, whatever that meant means at the time and now. And there it is, and there's the album. But then in '97, when I got the chance to redo it, I said, okay, well, you know, Burning of Rome is the track. Let's go with that and push all that stuff to the fore. That's really where my head was at and where Edward's head was at. And then I wrote Perfect Mansions to add to it, which is kind of like almost like a, in my mind, like emotionally a sequel to The Burning of Rome in some ways, and Serpent's Kiss. And that's really, you know, what that album should have been about, and now it is.
Now, you had the album Life Among the Ruins, and didn't get a great reception, but, you know, that record was really, really good for what it was, and it was a much different departure from the typical epic power metal that you guys you normally play. And talk a little bit about the making of that record, obviously, because you're going to reissue it, and it had like a bluesy vibe on it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just really where we were at the moment. It was like somewhere between Age of Consent and the putting of that album out. We would got back into like our roots of Zeppelin and I guess the Doors and, you know, things like that we, you know, grew up on, and we were jamming and playing some covers and things like that, and just got into that head, and those songs just came out at that point in time. It was done very quickly, and it wasn't even supposed to necessarily be an album. We just ended up going in the studio, recording a bunch of tracks, and we didn't have a deal at the time, and I sent over some things to a couple of labels, and one German label was very, very interested. They liked I Dress in Black very much, which is kind of, I guess, epic blues, if you will, and gave us some money to finish a record, and then we went back in and did things like Jet Black, Crown of Thorns, and the album, yeah, it turned out very bluesy, because that's just where we were at the time. It wasn't necessarily a style we were going to stay with forever, but it was just, you know, that window on that particular moment, and I really like that record, and it's a very personal record for me. It deals with a lot of the stuff that I was, you know, going through at the time, and getting a chance to do it now, I'm kind of in that head again, but, you know, of course, from a different perspective now, from having done, you know, Black Light Bacchanalia and Atreus and Marriage and everything else that we've done. So revisiting it with, you know, with a twofold view, you know, from where we were then and where we are now. And there's going to be some bizarre covers on this reissue. I'm actually doing a Zeppelin track that sounds... sounds pretty ripping. And there's some new things that I've written that probably will end up on there as well. So it's going to be bluesy, but it's going to be over the top. The bonus tracks and all those tracks will still be there. And there's actually a couple of acoustic things that are live rehearsal things that Edward and I did in my living room. And it's just two track, you know, straight up stereo live recordings that sound very cool.
Now, Verge of Steel has evolved quite a bit. You have played a lot of different types of metal. Well, really not a lot of different types, but you started out just a straight-ahead heavy metal band, then you went to more of the epic power metal, and then you've evolved to the more rock opera type stuff. And, you know, case in point, The House of Atreus Act 1 is one of my favorite albums that you guys have ever put out. And talk about evolving from, you know, one thing to another and doing the rock opera thing, and, you know, maybe talk a little bit about all of those albums. Those rock opera albums.
Sure, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Yes, they are quite theatrical. There's several reasons for that. The music has always lent itself towards that term, because I grew up with a guy in my house who was involved in theater, and my father. He was an actor and producer of plays, still is. So I grew up with Shakespeare and all the Greek tragedies and things like that, rehearsals going on at the house and seeing the productions and whatnot. So the whole dramatic aspect was ingrained in me early on, probably before even Into the Rock thing was. It was theater, then it was classical music, then it was rock music, and that inspired me. And I just distilled all those elements into what, you know, Verge of Steel is today. But the House of Atreus specifically was an opera. It was a heavy metal opera that I did in Germany. What happened was this theater called me up, the director of a theater in a town called Memmingen. This guy, Walter Weyers, he called me and said, I'd like you to write something like an opera for my company. And I immediately, my brain just flashed, oh, House of Atreus. Because this is a story I read as a kid and just stayed with me. And I thought, wow, that would make a really, really wonderful musical piece someday. And when he said, I want you to write something like an opera, my brain just flashed on that, and I said, I just blurted it out, House of Atreus, and he was like, oh, yeah, okay, I don't think he knew what I was talking about, but he just agreed with me. And I wrote this thing intending it to be performed on stage, and it was. The whole thing was done as you know, with actors and actresses and whatnot, and the music in Germany, and then that led to doing the Marriage of Heaven and Hell opera. We went back and made an opera out of that. And then that led to doing the Visions of Eden tracks as an operatic piece called Lilith. So I've done three of these heavy metal operas in Germany since the House of Atreus. And the House of Atreus record, it was inspired by the ancient tale of Euripides and Aeschylus. And I gave my own spin on the thing and what happens to the main character Orestes in the Verge of Steel album is not what happens in the versions of the Greek plays, and a few other details along the way. But I think it captures the feeling of this ancient tale, and I think it resonates today because all the myths, the Greek myths and whatever myths you have, you know, they're archetypes for humanity and their eternal truths and the eternal happenings that are still going on today. So it was very timely. It made a lot of sense to dive into that. It wasn't my intention to, you know, necessarily be timely or be anything. It just happened that way. I just saw the tale as this eternal struggle and just presented it as such. And life is an eternal struggle, isn't it? You know, we're always struggling in some way or another.
Now I'm curious to talk to you about the 70,000 tons of metal cruise, and I know you've probably played lots of shows, obviously, in your career, and you played a lot of festivals and done quite a few things from the live perspective over the last 25, 30 years, but, you know, the 70,000 tons of metal cruise seems pretty unique, and talk about what that was like to play on.
Sure. Yeah, that was definitely a first for us. We've done tons of festivals and venue shows and whatnot, but never played on a boat like that. And it was pretty insane. There were three stages. One was like a kind of a club, intimate club stage. One was a big theater stage, like the Beacon Theater or something like that in Radio City in New York. And one was an open air outside, you know, poolside stage. And we pulled out of Miami, I don't know, at 5 or 6 o'clock. Four in the afternoon, and they were still building the outside stage, so everything got kind of like pushed back. It was very crazy, the whole scheduling of the thing. No one quite always knew where they, what stage they were supposed to be on, because you took turns. Everybody did two sets, and you played one show in one venue, and the next show usually in a different venue, which is nice, because people got to see it in a different environment. I think there was 30 or 40 bands, so some of which I knew, like Hammerfall, you know, friends of ours, and people like that, so you know, got to kind of reconnect with people, and it was the kind of thing where the audience never goes home, so you're always on and available. Every time you walk out of your stateroom, there are people there who want to say hello or chat a bit or sign, have an autograph signed or whatever, take a picture. And it's just nonstop. From I think the metal started like the gigs started like 10 in the morning, and they went to like maybe 3 in the morning or something like that. And if you went to breakfast at 7 a.m. or whatever, there was, you know, metal happening in the wherever the food was happening, you know, in the catering. So it was pretty neat. It was nonstop for 3 days.
It sounds like a giant party.
It was. It was definitely a giant party. If you're looking to party and whatnot, it was pretty insane. I remember standing in the hallway, and this girl comes up to the maid who I was chatting with, because she was a fan, and this girl goes, "Oh, can you change the bedding in our room? My boyfriend, he threw up all over the bed." It's like endless stuff like that going on, people staying up for days, and just digging the whole vibe. If you love metal, it was the place to be.
Now talk a little bit about the upcoming album you're recording, and I know, how is it different, or how is it similar to, say, some of the past few albums that Virgin Steel has put out over the last 10 years?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I don't really know what's actually going to be on the next record. Where I have like three different song cycles or collections of songs that I'm writing, and two of them are conceptual. One is more of a straight ahead album, like a Noble Savage or an Asia Consent, and I'm not exactly sure which direction we're going with just yet. I'll probably know more in like another week or two which one we're actually going to present to the public, but I'm working on kind of like everything. It's kind of like globally working on stuff. I work pretty much nonstop. I'll work like, you know, a good portion of the day while there's daylight, and you know, I'll take a break a lot of times for dinner or whatever, and then I'll go back sometimes at 9, 10, or 11 o'clock at night, and I'll work till 4 in the morning. So it's hard to say what's going to be on the next record. I don't know. If you asked me like 2 weeks from now, I might have a better idea of what we're actually doing. One might be, one is definitely conceptual, another one is related to that concept, which I won't go into, but the third possible collection might be, when we did, just before we did Age of Consent, after we did Noble Savage, we ended up going in and doing some demos and other things. There's some things that got lost along the way. We might return to kind of a feel that was somewhere in between there, possibly. So, yeah, if you ask me again in a couple of weeks, I'll definitely have a better idea for you. I'm not sure where we're going yet.
You know, the great thing about interviewing veteran musicians like yourself who have done this for such a long time, and, you know, talk a bit about, I like to talk to people about the early days of the metal scene and get their perspectives on how things have evolved for them over the years. And you guys have obviously been around a very long time. And what was the metal scene like for you in the early days? And talk about the early days of Virgin Steel and what the metal scene up in New York was like, you know, back in the early 80s.
Well, it was definitely exciting. You know, it was bands like, I guess, you know, Saxon had broken, and Iron Maiden was coming up. And I remember we met Girl School. They were, you know, hanging out with Motorhead. And of course, Motorhead was coming up and all that. So Venom. So it was definitely exciting. We were on an English label called Music for Nations, and we were actually MFN, Music for Nations 1, the first release on this new label. And after us came Metallica, Wasp, Rat, Man of War, Merciful Fate, that were all on there. But we were actually, our first album was the first one. So it was exciting company, exciting place to be in. And the scene here down in New York was definitely wild and exciting. The clubs were open, you know, for like seven nights a week, you know. You could go out and see a band, and the place would be full on Tuesday night. You go to this place, Cheers, which was like just down the road from my house. There'd be 500-600 people, you know, in the room on a Tuesday night. On the weekend, you know, you'd have, 800 or whatever it fit. So it was pretty amazing. You know, we could play all these places locally, and it was always, quite a crowd
kids and people don't turn up for live shows like they used to, and just out of curiosity, why do you think that is?
Well, there's a lot more distractions now, you know, with people socialize with internet and whatnot, and they got their little gadgets and gizmos that they carry around with them, and some people are afraid of, I don't know, blowing out their eardrums or drinking and driving or you know, whatever the case may be, you know, I don't know. It's just more distractions and more, there's more governors on the thing. Like when the club scene was happening here, like in the 80s and whatnot, the drinking age, I think, was 18. Then it went up to 21, and then it changed somewhat some things, and then people really started cracking down on drinking and driving, so that was another, you know, nail in the coffin for the club scene. Not that everyone was driving around drunk, but you know, it made people think twice about such activities and whatnot, and the clubs themselves got a bit strange. They'd have like 500 bands on, and so the band you wanted to see was starting at like 1 or 2 in the morning, you know, where in the earlier times, just a year or so earlier, you could go out and there'd be 1 or 2 bands playing the whole night, and they would play the whole night. You know, they'd play 3 sets or whatever. We would play, you know, we got used to doing that kind of thing early on. So it was more conducive to going out and seeing the band, because you didn't have to wait till, you know, till 1 or 2 o'clock to see the band you wanted to see. So there's a lot of reasons, I think. It's not just one thing.
Over the course of your career, musical career, what are probably the 3 biggest highlights for you as a musician, and what are the 3 biggest highlights, accomplishments, whatever, that you've done over the course of your musical career?
Oh, God. There's been so many. I think going to Greece the first time was definitely like a major league high for us, because the audience was just so rabid, and for me personally, because I just, you know, I grew up in the theater and whatnot, and just I always felt a kinship to that part of the world and all those myths and whatnot, so that was, for me personally, a big high point. Being able to do the metal operas that I mentioned earlier, that was like a very, very noble, prestigious thing for me again. And just the fact that we're still here, we were able to still survive and make a way of life out of this thing. It wasn't really meant to be a career. If it was, we would have done things differently. We didn't have that kind of trajectory. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to do this, that, and the other thing and arrive at this point. It was really like, we like doing what we're doing. We want to make a way of life out of this thing that we can do pretty much indefinitely. And that's what we did. And I think that's what I am, and I think the rest of the band is most proud of, the fact that it is a way of life. It's not a career per se. We can do what we want to do. We make the kind of records that we want to make. Like, we can do A Life Among the Ruins, which is bluesy, and House of Atreus, which is this, you know, epic Greek thing, or anything in between, or whatever we want to do. You know, there are no rules. There's no rule book for us. There's nobody telling us we have to do this, that, or the other thing. And it's a nice place to be.
Now, over the years, and being a music fan yourself, obviously you probably have gone to a lot of shows and seen a lot of bands play, and you've obviously, you know, been around a long time, and, you know, what are some of your favorite bands you've ever seen live? I mean, just as a music fan, talk about some of the best concerts that you've ever been to. Talk about some of the best bands that you've ever seen play live over the years.
Yeah, I've seen so many great things. That Queen, I saw Queen, I think, like almost every time that they appeared in New York. I loved them. They were just so magical. It was incredible. You know, they were virtuoso performances, and it was theatrical, and it was just such a great vibe. You know, the feeling in the room was always tremendous. Zeppelin, I saw Zeppelin. They were, you know, wonderful to see. T-Rex was amazing. I'm a huge T-Rex fan, Bone T-Rex. Sabbath, of course. You know, Dio, you know, always wonderful performances. A band called Angel. I remember seeing them at the Beacon Theater. They were a really great band. They were kind of like Queen crossed with Yes, you know, like they had a multi-keyboard player. And I saw them a couple of times, and they were just really excellent. High energy, but you know, the classical thing happening as well. Yeah, quite cool.
It's funny that you mention that, because it's like almost everybody I've interviewed over the last, you know, year, a lot of people say Queen is the best band they've ever seen live.
Yeah, Queen was just amazing. amazing. You know, it was a major league influence on me. Queen 2, especially. I was like, oh my God, you know, what an amazing album. It just, like, I don't know, it just changed my life in a multitude of ways. I said, well, wow, this is just like where I want to be. That, you know, the Queen 1, Queen 2, Zeppelin 1, Zeppelin 2, those are probably like the foundation stones for me.
Well, the other thing is that they were one of the first bands to experiment with the layered vocals, and when no one else was doing that at the time.
Yeah, yeah, just tremendous amounts of overdubs and whatnot, and just the music was just, the harmonies were just so, I mean, just, you know, the chordal harmonies and how they just made all those progressions come alive between the guitar, bass, piano, drums, and of course all the incredible vocals.
Well, David, it's been great to be able to speak to you once again and have you on the show, and as I do with all the bands, I ask them, do you have any last words you want to say to the fans? And also, what can we expect from Virgin Steel in 2012 over the course of the next year?
Sure, sure. I hope we're going to get the new album done. I think we're going to. I think, you know, we're you know, breaking our asses to make it happen. If we don't deliver the album by the end of this year, it will come out early the following year, I'm sure. And the only reason why it would be delayed is because when we don't just go in and do 10 songs and that's it. When there's a new album, I write like 30 songs or more, and there's so many ideas that we try, and then we try to determine what's going to make the most sense as a collection, you know, for that release. So that's what actually takes longer. So when people think, oh, you know, that's all they did or whatever, you know, it's only 70 minutes or it's only 80 minutes or it's only 50 minutes. Well, no, we did, you know, 3 hours of stuff to get to that point. So we're going to try to make that happen, and there's going to be more reissues with bonus tracks. All the records are going to come out. There's going to be more full-on new albums. There'll be more gigs. There'll be more of everything. Videos. We're starting to, you know, delve into that as well. So there'll be more of that. And we just like to say thanks to everyone who's been with us and or just coming on board. Just thanks for listening. Thanks for believing in the band. And we hope to see you on stage quite soon again.